Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Fake the Nation, episode 378.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about culture, and where we marvel at the fact that candy corn is the eighth most popular candy in America today. I'm your host, Nagin Farsad, and I find that placement really shocking. By the way, the most popular is Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, the second in line is M&M's, and the third, another shocker, is Hot Tamales. Hot tamales, that has a hold over the American consumer? I truly had no idea. Today, we will talk about not that, but instead OnlyFans and teachers. Yeah, those two things in one sentence. We will also talk about the tragic war. And finally, we'll ask if the 21st century is the least innovative artistic century. And folks, today is a very, very special episode of Fake the Nation because we have just one panelist, and she's so incredible that she can actually fill in for like five panelists in at once. That's first of all, this woman was like, I said, how should I introduce you? And she said one of her roles, but she has so many roles. She is a journalist. She is she teaches a journalism course. She's just like a phenomenal writer. I mean, I have her book literally at home in my bookcase, prominently displayed. You know, and more than anything right now, she's a political communications consultant. And man, and you'll see, by the way, she knows how to like talk about these issues, why that is. She is the wonderful Sally Cohn. Hey, Sally.
Gosh, did you feel like you needed to give me an introduction for two people?
No, just you are the kind of person that I feel like requires an introduction for two people because that's how great you are. That's what.
I feel like this is a little dangerous because people might find out how much we love each other and we might forget that people are going to listen to our conversation.
I know. Right. Like this is actually being, will be broadcast to lots of people. It's not just us in the room. We will forget. But my first question before we get into the show is like, did you think, A, that candy corn was the eighth most popular candy or that hot tamales was the third most popular candy? Was that surprising to you at all?
You know, yes, until you realize that Donald Trump was the second most popular presidential choice. So I think I'm really out of touch with
right.
a good third of the country.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming... Now, here's the thing. I also am going to say, I think a lot of people are probably buying candy corn and not eating it. You know what I mean? Like you put it in a decorative bowl.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
I can see
for
that
a month
happening.
Or so, but I don't know if you eat it. Although I'm going to be honest, I don't hate the stuff. It just wouldn't rank anywhere near
like,
my top 10.
I actually love it, but I can only have, I can do like five a day for like a week. And then I have to take a month off, I think is like what it is.
But now Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Unless any, if
those
the, people,
are
the nice people from Reese's are listening, you know?
Yeah. I know. If you want to unload your product on a podcast, Fake the Nation is here for you. Reese's Peanut Butter Cups forever and always. Like that is a tremendous candy. But I also just want to say hot tamales, like what the fuck? I mean, no offense to whoever invented hot tamales. Like you're, I'm sure you're like a really nice person and have a lot of great ideas or whatever. Like I don't get that at number three. I don't get it. I am going to just begrudgingly tolerate that statistic. For whatever it's worth. And people of Fake Nation, come at me if you feel like super offended by that.
I guess we all tend to see things through our own lens, so guilty. But like, where the hell are the Skittles? Skittles or at least Starburst? What happened to Lifesavers? Like there's a whole bunch of things
like
I would have
so many.
Bet money. I would have bet money ended up above.
Yeah, because the other thing was like Hershey's Kisses were on there, but so were Hershey's little snack little mini bars, which is the same product at the end of the day. And so I'm like, how are they even getting separate items on a 10 item list, you know? So they're overrepresented. And yeah, I don't know. Look, we have a lot to do. Well, we have a lot to do in figuring out the American public. Before we get into the show, I want to just remind listeners that talking about American public, we are doing recap episodes of The Golden Bachelor every other Friday. Those are dropping. You can see that show on Hulu/ABC. It airs on Thursday nights. Man, we had a really great time talking about that for the first couple of episodes. There is a handsome, nerdly man at the center of it all. He is the Golden Bachelor. Gary, I mean, there's so much to say about him. He cries a lot. I don't know. I mean, getting texts from friends and DMs from listeners about, like, I can't believe you're making me watch The Golden Bachelor, but I am, and I'm riveted, and I'm crying a lot, and so did I, okay? I cannot wait for this week's episode. I cannot wait to recap. So tune in to Fake the Nation. We'll drop in your feed every other Friday for as long as The Golden Bachelor is on, and don't forget to go to patreon.com/NagineFarsad to subscribe to the show for bonus episodes. That's patreon.com/NagineFarsad, and thanks to everyone who already subscribes, and now let us get into it with topic number one. So a 28-year-old English teacher in Missouri was put on a leave of absence after someone had discovered her OnlyFans page. She was earning $42,000 on that side gig and has since resigned from teaching to pursue her pornography career. So my first question for you is, what do you think of a teacher having an OnlyFans account? Is it a conflict of interest? Is it inappropriate? At first blush, what do you think?
Well, I am blushing with this conversation, so good tee up, Farsad. I'm against it. I empathize with the fact that we pay teachers ridiculously low in this country for what they have to do. And it was a hard job before the pandemic. It got unimaginably hard during the pandemic, pivoting to remote learning, then hybrid, then all of that. And now, frankly, it is an untenable job because a small authoritarian faction of parents have decided that they should have more power, not only over their own children's education, but over all children's education than professional, experienced, knowledgeable teachers, and are making teachers' lives hell. So I get wanting an outlet that pays your money and all of that. Totally sympathize. And at the same time, probably just a super bad idea, right? Like, and I, you know,
what if she was like working at a Hooters?
That's just what I was thinking. Like, okay, what if, you know, and again, like, I don't want to, this isn't about obviously shaming, women or money or whatever. Yeah. I guess what I'm aware of, so look, my context is, right, I now live in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, which is one of those purple ruralish counties where that small authoritarian faction has taken over the school board and set about banning books and banning pride flags and attacking teachers as, like, you know, trying to turn kids gay and over sexualize whatever. And like, it's utter, total, complete bullshit. Yeah, parents need to support their kids, but thank God there are teachers who can support, educate kids when their parents aren't or don't, right? Including kids who are lesbian, gay, bi, or trans. And into that melee, stuff like this is extremely unhelpful, right? Teachers who are sort of like, you know what? This is where I'm a little bit of a prude and I'm comfortable with that. So,
okay.
But, I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, it's funny because in the abstract, I think like, it should be okay. Like if it, you know, if she, like, I guess if she had a job at Hooters, like, I don't know what I would, I would also be like, it's contained, right? the boobs are contained in one room. You know what I mean? But so that I think would sort of like be okay. I think like the amount that again, and I just want to like 500% echo what you said. I don't care if someone is on OnlyFans. Like I know people that are on OnlyFans. It's fine. I really don't care. What I think is it's just like the children thing is it is weird. I think if I got to be honest, I'm so on the fence on this one. I can see both sides. If I if my kid had a teacher that was on OnlyFans, I'm like, you know, she's four. How she's never going to see it. It's not like she's going to be exposed to it. I guess with
that's a high school teacher.
It's the high. So. She's a high school teacher. That is, I think, the part of the problem is that those kids are now online. They might see that stuff, whatever. And then you just don't want to kind of like have an image of your teacher that is disruptive to the classroom. That I think is wrong. Again, if it, like oddly, if she was teaching preschool, I'd be like, guys, give her a break. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I feel I'm listening to you and I think we might both be trying to tie ourselves in knots to be like, well, it's not a bad choice in the abstract. It's just maybe a bad choice for a teacher. And that's I think that's okay, right?
Right.
Like, I don't want to say just maybe this is another way of coming at it. Just because you have, again, this sort of, you know, kind of far right, power hungry group that is hell bent on trying to moralize schools and teachers and like kids should be this and not that. And like, you know, ostensibly obliterate anything that is queer in schools. And right. Just because you have that faction that is a very intensely moralistic faction doesn't mean there shouldn't be, frankly, moral standards that apply to teachers.
Right.
And I think this one, you know, are there others that we could debate, you know, does that cross a line or not or whatever? But this one feels pretty much like it crosses a line to me. And again, in that debate where so we're having such a politicized debate about ostensibly this sort of faux morality as a way to actually undermine teachers, undermine teachers' unions, undermine public schools, et cetera. It just kind of makes me sad in that moment. While again, at the same time, it's like root cause. If teachers were getting paid what they were worth, no one would be doing stuff like this.
You know, I think hearing you talk about it has really like clarified my feelings. My feelings are thusly. I wish that we treated teachers, you know, there's places like if you go to Iran or if you go to Czechoslovakia or whatever, there's like there's parts of the world where being a teacher is such an elevated position. It's like doctor, teacher, you know what I mean? It's like that people talk about them like that. Now, I wish we had that in the United States, that feeling. I personally have that feeling, and I know a lot of people that have that feeling that do elevate teachers in that way, but just like writ large, we don't because we don't pay them enough. Like the way that we pay them is not does not indicative of putting them on a pedestal. I would like to put teachers on a pedestal. Now, in a world where teachers are on a pedestal, unfortunately, that also means they're on a sort of ethical pedestal, they're on a moral pedestal, they're like, they're exemplars as when it comes to, you know, the citizenry. And so in that sense, you want them to, like, I would also be probably uncomfortable with, like, a teacher who also, like, owns, I don't know, like, a cigar shop or something like that. You know what I mean? It's just, like, what they do.
Definitely a vape shop. Oh my god, no.
No thanks. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Vape shop. And so those are the kinds of things that like you know, because we pay teachers so much, we also expect them to uphold some sort of a standard of what a person should be. But we don't do that. So there's part of it that's missing, which is why I'm more sympathetic in this situation. But I think in an ideally, she would not have an OnlyFans page. I also want to point out that last week in Minneapolis, there was a 35-year-old officer who could now lose her job because she pulled someone over and that person recognized her from her OnlyFans page. This is like a decorated officer who's actually been recognized by the Minneapolis Police Department for her police work. So again, police officers, another different can of like, what kind of person do they represent? You know, they're these people that are supposed, you know, upholding the law. Again, not that OnlyFans is against the law, it's not. But just that, like, what do we want from these people? How do we want them to, like, be as, you know, as citizens with that job? These are kind of special jobs. I think the same of, like, I don't know. I do think the same of doctors.
Politicians. I think the same politicians. I think the same of doctors, right? Yep. Like, you were, you know, the that is the burden and the benefit of those kinds of roles, is you are called to a form of community leadership and a higher moral ethical standard. And that, you know, is, I think, again, I think it is entirely entirely fair.
All right, folks, let me know.
Wow, we made it through that one.
We made it through that one. I'm so curious. What do you think? I feel like this is like my favorite kind of discussion because it is an ethical conundrum. It's difficult. And I'm so curious to know where you folks land on it. So hit me up and we're going to take a quick break to learn about our sponsors. And when we're back, we're going to continue chatting. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app, and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money, and because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry, thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you, so you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a like a roundabout 8 exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Instant Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. And we are back and we're ready for topic number two. Now, as you've noticed by now, we still only have one panelist on the show. Part of the reason we don't have a second panelist, I think, is because this topic, as everyone has heard by now, and I don't even know how to talk. I just want to say from the start, I don't know how to talk about this. And I felt like we had to mention it. So, and I don't feel particularly qualified to talk about it. There you go. So all of those things are true. Here we go. But as you've heard by now, Hamas, a Palestinian militant group that controls the Gaza Strip, launched a surprise attack on Israel, entering areas near the Gaza Strip, killing hundreds and taking dozens of hostages. It was really brutal. A brutal display of force. In response, Israel bombarded downtown Gaza City. This is now a war. Hamas has been widely condemned, although we could talk about how widely. And again, just for a bit of context, in case listeners don't know, the Gaza Strip has over 2 million residents. It's one of the most densely populated areas of the world, and all the points of entry are heavily controlled by Israel. So considering the large-scale surveillance, this is also being viewed as a massive intelligence failure for Israel. And simultaneously, you know, there are questions that have arisen about the conditions in the Gaza Strip to begin with. It's a thorny issue. But one thing that everyone can agree on is that the loss of life is extremely, extremely fucking sad. So, Sally, what do you make of this conflict? Is it as difficult for you to talk about it as it is for me?
It is. Well, it is for several reasons, right? First and foremost, the sheer brutality of what's happening. And you know, yes, brutal things are always happening at all times all around the world when they happen in rapid succession. Such, frankly, just extreme dehumanizing violence, mm-hmm. Brutality.
To like families, to families.
To families, to children. You know, stories of Hamas killing people right in front of their children, kidnapping children, you know, raping and torturing people. It is impossible to feel comfortable talking about it because it's just wrenching. I also think that it is hard to talk about. So that's just like, that is for me, 80%.
Yeah.
Of why this is hard to talk about. The rest is some mix of, you know, historically, this is a complicated issue to wade into. And it's complicated because I feel like, you know, as an American, as an American Jew, I know, you know, a thimbleful.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I don't know. And I know my knowledge and experience and ideas have been shaped by a lot of what I've been exposed to, but also what I've been not exposed to, what I haven't known. And it's just a issue that it feels like it's just, there's a lot of landmines. I don't want to step in the landmines. And at the same time, I want to very clearly stand for peace, not just in this moment, but in the past and going forward, right? A peaceful resolution, a peaceful future for Israelis, for Palestinians, for Muslims, for Jews, that recognizes the full and equal humanity of all of the above, and a solution that allows everyone to live in freedom. And I think one of the heartbreaking things about this moment is it feels like that goal is getting further away, not closer. Mm. And that every time, I feel like it's very fraught to talk about that history, that context, the histories of violence and injustice, and not just this moment. And I don't want to, when I do that in any way, shape, or form, minimize the extreme atrocity and severity of what is happening in this moment.
Yeah, beautifully said, Sally. I would say on the note of diplomacy, and you know, the idea of peace for the region, you know, I did this this show called The Reason We're All Still Here. It's another podcast. And we talked about the Iran nuclear deal on that show. And, you know, the Iran nuclear deal when Trump took over was like ended, and for the American involvement was ended. And then, the status is just kind of like unclear and weak and whatever. But like my feeling about deals like that is that the idea is to bring these countries that are largely considered rogue or unstable or headed by authoritarians, to bring them in the fold and kind of help them get on board with international diplomacy, the global economy, and like, let's try and change things for those countries economically, and then hopefully the politics will follow, you know? And the, you know, us kind of like pushing countries like that out of the conversation, I think makes the goal of peace in that region much harder. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we can thank people like Trump for making that goal a little further away, mm-hmm. but with actions like, you know, getting rid of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. So, the Gaza Strip elected Hamas in 2007. Like, I don't understand. I don't understand that. Huh. You know what I mean? I just started reading some things about the Gaza Strip, and about 80% of the population depends on international aid, and 1 million people per day rely on food aid, international food mm-hmm. aid. So it's like a really economically depressed place. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what happens and what's got to happen, but that doesn't sound, those numbers don't sound right also, in terms of like how 2 million people have been living. And again, and the brutality is extremely wrong, and all of those things are true.
I also don't understand how Israelis reinstalled Netanyahu and an authoritarian right in Israel. And I feel like, I grew up in an era in Judaism writ large where you just kind of, you know, your oof, watch out for these landmines, Cone. These the unquestioning support for mm-hmm. Israel was mm-hmm. considered part and parcel with Judaism and even liberal Jewish traditions. And mm-hmm. and I think that has shifted in a lot of ways, in constructive ways, where you hear more, you know, as there have always been, by the way, Israelis who've been critical of the Israeli relationship and actions in Palestinian territories, more and more American Jews who are critical of that, because you have to bear in mind the reason that Israel is able to do what it does is because it is propped up and its military is supported by much larger, more powerful nations, namely the United States. And so that had changed. And, you know, and I can see that any sense of progress or potential peace, frankly, eroded over the last, you know, 6+ years, both with Trump and with Netanyahu, and with a sense of, you know, might is right, and, you know, there should be winners and losers and regions and so forth, and that this should, you know, so I think part of why I feel so bereft right now is not just obviously at the incredible dramatic loss of life and suffering, but it also feels like this will be a setback. And I don't, yeah. You know, look, I don't know that many people, but I know more Palestinians, you know, I don't know any Palestinians actually who support Hamas. I don't.
Me neither.
And, you know, by the way, I also know a number of Israelis, and I don't know many Israelis, and I know very few American Jews who support settlements and sort of, you know, would have been ruled to be by international tribunals, illegal incursions into Palestinian land. So, and yet here we are, and it's, oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. My heart breaks. And also, I feel like there's this pressure to say something or to think something.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and who the fuck cares what I think? You know? And at the same time, I also know that what me and my brethren, you know, that we create the container for what is possible and what is accepted. And I guess what I think is killing is wrong.
Yeah.
And oppression is wrong. And occupation is wrong, and violence is wrong, and I am worried it is just going to get worse now, and my heart breaks.
Yeah, and I also think it's like also especially interesting when you look at the history of diplomacy. I feel like I came of age, like I was an adolescent or something when Clinton and the handshake and all that stuff. And so it felt like a more hopeful time, and it sort of felt like it would only get better from there. And then it did not get better from there. That's, I think, also just like, it's just so sad and disappointing because you, in the sliding doors version of this, you can see like a different outcome on a day like today. Folks, as you can see, Sally and I, also, I think that's great. Like, it's okay not to like have a specific, you know, boiled down to a few bullet points, you know, feelings about this. It's like, it's just so sad and horrible. And I think you're right. I'm against killing. I'm against oppression of all kinds. That's like the number one thing. Folks, let me know. What do you think? It's a terrible time. So let us move on to our final topic. We read a piece in the New York Times. This is just a huge palate cleanser, folks. We read a piece by Jason Farrago called "Ours is the Least Artistically Innovative Century in 500 Years." But baby, it's not as bad as it sounds. On the front of the end of the piece, he lays out what art was or tried to be. He writes, quote, "To speak to your time, we once believed, we required much more than new content. It required a commitment to new modes of narration, new styles of expression that could bear witness to see changes in society. He pointed out that in the 1800s, quote, the creators who mostly decisively marked the history of art again and again described their work as a search for a new language, a new style, a new way of being. And he used Manet as an example. It's all very convincing. But my question for you, Sally, is do you agree with him that we no longer do that in the 21st century? Like, we no longer look for new modes of language making and communication? Are we, in fact, the least artistically innovative century?
Well, first of all, like, the century isn't over yet, motherfucker. What the hell? am I wrong? Like, I can't do math really well, but, like, we've got a ways to go. So, fuck you.
But this quarter of a century does not feel...
And second, we're dealing with a lot of shit. Ibid the previous conversation. So, I mean, right? Also, the planet is dying. We had a pandemic. Like, a lot's going on. And okay, so putting that aside for a second, I feel like, give me a break. Also, I found that piece to be, frankly, chokingly elitist. Chokingly elitist. Like, so just so we're clear, folks, and by the way, there were, like, parts of it I was like, well, I don't understand that paragraph, so I'm fucking skipping that paragraph, but...
It was a lot. It was very densely written.
Obviously, I needed a palate cleanser. Thank you, Nagin. except that I'm still like, I'm like holding back tears. I'm like, but I want to cry now because we were talking. Okay. So
emotional
fucking
roller coaster episode.
Jesus, man. Jesus. All right. Yeah. Who decides what culture is? I mean, this is the thing, right? Like, and I will say, I don't know enough to know a lot, but I'm on your damn show, so I'm going to pretend like I do. And I will say that some of the stuff that we think of as like fancy fucking culture now from 200 years ago or 300 years ago, whatever, was like garbage trash then. So I don't know. You know, do I think in 3 centuries, people will still be talking about Doja Cat? God, I hope not. But like, are people doing interesting things around micro communication on TikTok and finding new innovative forms of kind of public performative art? And, you know, right? Like, do I get it? No. Is it possible to recognize true ground shifting stuff in when it's actually happening? I don't think it is. But I found that piece sort of like, just dripping with snooty elitism and like, you know, well, nothing make today is as fancy as elitist to pass. Like,
okay. But I will push back.
Because you're an elitist, go ahead.
Because I'm an elitist. Uh-huh. I will ask you a question that he asks in the piece, which is, he writes, what piece of clothing or accessory would you give a model to mark her as young lady in 2023? That's a Manet piece that he was referring to that was like the quintessential young lady in 1886. He writes, a titanium-cased iPhone is all that comes to my mind, and even that hasn't changed its appearance much in a decade. And I kind of agree with that. Like, I don't... Fashion-wise, and he also describes people watching in the museum, and he was saying people wearing skinny jeans of the 2000s or high-waisted jeans of the 90s, and I feel like, and I personally feel like, you know, fashion is just so iterative, or it's just like going through a cycle. We're just seeing the same things, like the same things I was wearing in the early 2000s. I'm just like wearing, you know, those things are coming out again, and that's all everyone's wearing. It doesn't feel, there is not a newness. Like, I keep waiting, you know, I'm waiting for, like, you know, the scenes in the Hunger Games where they go to the fancy part of the country, whatever the district that is.
The capital, right.
I'm like, when are we all wearing ball gowns at 9 a.m. and blue hair? You know what I mean? Like, that's what I'm waiting for. I'm waiting for the Hunger Games vision of the future to, like, take over our fashion. Something that just feels wild, and we're not doing it. We're just in yoga pants. We're fucking two decades of yoga pants, and I can't take it anymore. Like, can we please? And so there is some, like, what would you say defines us for fashion?
But again, when you look at, just on the fashion level, when you look at those, you know, the Renoirs, and the, it's not like they were wearing anything that was a radical, innovative departure either. And right? Like, it was just more like, ooh, women get to wear pants. Like, it wasn't, Right? It was the sort of, no, but think about it. It was like the social evolution of like who was allowed to do what in what clothes. It wasn't like at some point, I guess pants were an innovation too, but that, I don't know that date, but you get my point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know if you and I were those people, y'all, editor's note, Nagin actually isn't a fancy elitist. If she really was, she'd be like, quoting some like, hit couture that just was on the scenes
which
of
I cannot do.
Fashion Week and be like, here's the innovation in here. And she'd go into some like Meryl Streep Devil Wears Prada monologue about how that, you know, metal bustier from, you know, whoever, right, is making its way down to a new belt buckle. So I don't fucking know. But I also do think, I guess my biggest takeaway when I read it was what I started with, which is, look, we're having this conversation alongside of how many wars are now brewing or active. You know, the planet is clearly dying.
Need some help. Yeah.
Let's not forget the pandemic. Let's not forget the fact that, you know, like yawning economic inequality, people kind of suffering and yet self-soothing and checking out with their devices and their TVs and their streaming and whatever. So there is maybe something to be said for, if we go like back to basics, Maslow's hierarchy of needs here, that like we're not able to focus on our elite fancy cultural creations because, right, we're trying to survive. I mean, honestly, the artists who I, when we talk about art, like pedestal art, fancy art, the artists who I am paying the most attention to, and frankly, who are getting the most, I think who are getting the most cachet and sort of, energy right now are the artists who are responding to the political, cultural, and environmental moment we're in. They're not creating art for art's sake, because art for art's sake right now feels like a luxury. And so the art itself, whether we're talking writing or painting or sculpture or whatever, may feel less innovative because it's not imagining some future, or it's not taking the luxury of like, oh, let me just play over here. Right? It is urgent. It is
reactive.
Of the moment. It is reactive. It is soothing of this moment or something. It's commentary on this moment, or trying to be a portal out of this moment. But it maybe doesn't feel that, I don't know.
Revolutionary or
outside of the moment.
Because
the moment is so all-encompassing and defining when we're in a moment of kind of human crisis.
Well, can I?
Take that, New York Times.
I think this, first of all, who out there wants to transcribe what Sally just said? Because that should be the editor's letter to the Times for that piece. I think that was beautifully said. I will say one thing, which is that there's something about also this moment that feels like we prize technological innovation more than we do artistic innovation. And so, like, I was talking to a friend of mine. I was in San Francisco last week, thanks to everyone who came out to see Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me in San Francisco. And I was remembering, you know, what my first feature film in 2010 had its West Coast premiere, whatever, in San Francisco.
Such a fucking flex. Listeners, did you all hear that? My first feature film. Yeah, go on.
Wait, I have others. And so anyways, okay. I'm a dick, but here's the deal. When my first feature film premiered, on the West Coast, it opened in a theater in San Francisco, and I'm blanking on the name. And this theater was in the Haight, and it was like a beloved theater. It had been the beloved cinema, independent cinema. It was like sort of like the, you know, the like Angelica of San Francisco or whatever. People loved going to this place. And I mean, I loved having my movie there. It was such a fun time. And I was just, this one cinema has like a place in my heart. That place closed. And it closed because San Francisco became this, a place that a lot of tech people live, and they start, and they don't, it's like tech is the art. Like it's not, art is not the art. And so stuff like cinemas and theaters or whatever just don't have the same place in San Francisco as they once were. And I feel like the primacy of technology is like taken over. And that makes me sad. And it also, you know, we're so obsessed with how we receive things, we don't care about the quality of the thing we're receiving. Right. So it's all about, like, how are you receiving a text, in what platform? How are you receiving video? How are you receiving, how, you know, and how can you iterate on a video that you are receiving? It's all about that. That's the art. And it's like, that's not art. That's actually technology. And we just are just prizing technology now in a way. And I think it's cyclical. I think we're going to move away. We're going to I increasingly care fucking way less and less and less about a new iPhone. I don't give a shit. Right. Like, I don't care. What are the new features it has? How much better does it need to be? I don't care. You know what I mean? It already does too much, you know? So I feel like it is a cycle, and hopefully the rest of the world will come on board with my feeling that the iPhone should not advance anymore. And hopefully, if Tim Cook is listening, if he's even the guy, or Tim Apple as he's known, maybe he can, if you're listening, I say you're good. You could just stop now. and focus on building great cinema. I would also say, you know, if you think of like, because there was a similar piece like this several months ago about music. If you like think about music, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, they have a very distinct sound, and then it stops. Like, and then it's just like a mush of things you basically knew if you were around in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Like, if you're familiar with that, those eras of music, then the 10s and the 20s are that you already know them, you know? So that stuff does feel real.
I stop and think, like, because, you know, I have a 15-year-old.
Right.
And incidentally, she listens to, like, a lot of 70s and 80s and 90s music because she's awesome. But when she listens to new stuff, I will. I'll think, like, I'll try to listen with a, will this become an iconic song of the, right? Yes. And it's interesting. It is true. I would say less and less of it. Like, it's part of it is, I can't tell. I don't know enough to know. Is that about the quality of the music, right? Like, none of these songs are just truly great, or these artists, or is it about the quantity of it? There's so friggin' much that, like, for a song to have become iconic in the 80s, it needed to be like the song everybody was talking about for, like, you know, more than a week. I don't know if that happens as much anymore. And so it could also be that it's just, you know, that part of what could be true, I agree with everything you said about technology and all the sort of AI art now, air quotes, is part of that. But it also could be true that there's just so much content that even if there are some gems in there, we don't notice them in the same way because they're just buried under mountains of crap. Or there's enough other kind of good stuff, you know, that nothing is like jumps out. I don't know, man.
Yeah, it's
smart enough for this conversation.
No, this is great. I mean, I feel like we need a sort of Barbenheimer moment for like a playlist. You know what I mean? Because otherwise it's not gonna, you're right, it's just not gonna rise to the top. We're not gonna notice it unless there's some specific thing. And I think Barbenheimer will go in the history books of cinema, but only because of this thing that happened around its marketing, you know what I mean?
Not necessarily because of like its quality. Like, it's not gonna,
And look, I saw both movies. I thought they were both like great movies. You know what I mean? It's so, but
I haven't seen Oppenheimer yet. Don't ruin the ending for me.
I think I talked about it in the show, but
happens?
What happened to Nagin Farsad was I got stressed the fuck out, but you go enjoy and go into it with some breathing techniques
or some beta blockers.
Exactly. Oh, cool. I do wish I was like a little stoned having watched it. Maybe I would have calmed. It would have been a calmer experience.
I think stoned would make it worse. I don't know.
I haven't seen the film. It could have turned into
history.
Maybe that's not right. Maybe that's not right. Maybe stone isn't right. Folks, we did it. We talked about whether or not this entire century's art is fucking worth it at all. By the way, I was so pissed reading this piece because I was like, motherfucker, I'm creating shit in this century. So you're just like, this whole century is done, I guess. Like, and I still have to make shit in it, and it doesn't matter because it's just not ever going to be noteworthy, like compared to things of the past.
No, he's just challenging you to make that thing that will endure.
Right. And you know what, folks? Are you taking the challenge? Let's all take the challenge. Like, what if, yeah, it's a, in 50 years from now, people are going to be talking about Fake the Nation.
Well, no, but they're going to talk about, what is it, your fifth feature film.
Right, right, yeah. There you go. Well, folks, let me know what you think. Check out this piece and let me know if it's chokingly elitist, as it was described.
What asshole said that?
I think that was the best description of anything I've ever heard. I'm taking that with me. That's going in the diary. And folks, that is the end of the show. And I just want to thank Sally Cohen, and Sally Cohen for being on the show. Our many panelists who filled out this conversation. Such a fantastic time. And I knew, I was like, well, if it was going to be anyone who had to be, to just talk to me alone, it would, Sally's the one that could handle it.
Am I the only person to ever do this? Is this like,
no,
do I get a badge?
You know who else has done it? Oh, I think you would appreciate who else has done it. Ophira Eisenberg.
Okay.
And David Cross.
I mean, I feel like I'm in good company here.
You're in tremendous company. Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. You're now.
I would like a t-shirt that says third time, one timer, or something like that.
We're going to get you a t-shirt that's, because now you're part of the chokingly elite. Because
I mean, we could sell those bumper stickers and do very well.
Absolutely. Everyone in Pennsylvania will have it on their car. Sally, where do people find you and all the wonderful things that you do?
Oh, they find me at Sally Cohen, Kohn.
Folks, please follow everything that she does because it's so fantastic. And you know where to find me and all things that I do. And don't forget The Golden Bachelor every other Friday. And you can find me. I have dates in Philadelphia. I have dates in D.C. I'm going to be at the Kennedy Center, and I'm going to be in Virginia. So please look at the dates at NagineFarsad.com. I cannot wait to see you. It's so great to see Fake the Nation listeners in the wild. Sometimes they wear their t-shirt. My heart fills with such joy when I see Fake Nation listeners in the wild. It's always great to see you guys. I'm going to be doing my hour in Reston, Virginia. So definitely look up that date. All right. And that, and I want to thank everyone who makes the show a possibility. That's our wonderful producer, Andrew McGuire. Our fantastic theme music was written by Gabi Alter. And thanks to everyone at HeadGum for making the show a possibility. If you have any thoughts, you can reach us at fakethenationpodcast@gmail.com. And again, go to patreon.com/NagineFarsad to support the show. And otherwise, we will be back in your earballs next week.
That was a HeadGum podcast.